reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen, and Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this, and somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan, because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issue. So and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show, and thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace, and let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan, but at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week. Allahu Allahu
Allahu Allah Allahu Allah. IRIB English Radio presents
the month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Allahumma Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalam ala ashrafil anbiya'i wal mursaleen, Sayyidina Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad.
Welcome to the program Month of Allah. Today we're going to talk about some of the wisdoms behind fasting. I'm sure you've heard of the verse in Surah Al-Baqarah, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, kutiba alaykum al-siyam, kama kutiba ala alladhina min qablikum, la'allakum tattaqoon. O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become God conscious, that you may have taqwa. One of the wisdoms or philosophies behind fasting is that it creates taqwa in us. How does fasting create taqwa? One of the scholars by the name of Mullah Naraqi, he has a book by the name of Jama'u Sa'adat. In this book, he divides the abilities that man has and the different powers that he has. The power of the intellect, the power of the desires, the power of anger, and the power of imagination. And he divides the different attributes that mankind has inside each of every one of these powers. So for us to be able to live a healthy and an Islamic life, for us to have taqwa, we need to strengthen our ability of aql and intellect. And this aql and intellect will overrule and oversee our anger, will overrule and oversee our shahwat and our lust, our lower desires, and also our power of imagination. It will all be controlled by the aql. Our aql will tell us when you should have lust in a halal way, when you should have anger in the right manner, what you should think about, what you should imagine about. So this is an ability that we need to strengthen, and that is in the month of Ramadan when we fast, we are in actuality strengthening the power of aql, intellect, to make the correct decisions. Prophet Adam alayhi salam, in a narration in Usul al-Kafi, which is at the beginning of the book of intellect, he has three different things that he can choose from. Either aql, intellect, or he can choose deen, religion, or he can choose haya or modesty. He chooses aql. And when he chooses aql, the other two say, we follow wherever intellect and aql follows. Modesty and religion follow wherever intellect and aql follow. So in the month of Ramadan, when we are fasting, we are strengthening our ability, our quwwah of aql. And we are controlling our desires. We are also controlling our anger. And this is the essence of taqwa, to have this ability to control all the different powers in your life, all the different forces you have with your aql. And that is the difference between an animal and an angel and a human. Animals only have these desires, they don't use their aql. Angels only have aql, but mankind both has aql and also has shahwat and also has ghadab, and he is in a role to fulfill his obligations by monitoring and controlling everything by his aql. When we look at some of the other dimensions of the philosophies behind fasting, we see social dimensions. In a tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, it says one of the purposes of fasting is that so the rich and the poor can become equal, so that the rich understand what the poor people are going through. So that the rich, when they are deprived of food, they see how difficult it is not to have food. There are many people starving in America, many people starving in the Western world, many people starving, especially say countries like Yemen. When we are fasting, this causes us to realize what difficulties these people are facing when they don't have food. So it brings the rich and the poor together. Another philosophy or wisdom or benefit of the month of Ramadan, as we have in the tradition, sumu tasihu. We say sumu tasihu. Fast and you will be healthy. There are many recent studies done that if we start fasting in a certain part in the day, we're actually allowing our body to rest. That less insulin will be injected throughout the body, and maybe there will be a less chance of getting diabetes. That different cells that we have inside our body, these are theories, that these cells will be replenished. When you're fasting, these cells will be replenished more. Or for example, when it comes to our dental health, that when you keep eating and munching on different things throughout the day, you are causing your mouth to be more acidic, causing more cavities. Therefore, when you fast, you're giving your mouth, you're giving your teeth a rest, you're giving your digestive system a rest. And it is a great way for us to increase our health. And it's very interesting that many modern day scientists are coming to the conclusions that fasting is actually beneficial for our health. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ahla bayti tayyibin tahirin.
قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله صوموا تصحوا.
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله said, fast and you will be healthy.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله ما لنا رب سوى
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Since we are in the month of Ramadan, we are going to, in fact, hover around the questions around fasting and Ramadan, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
SubhanAllah.
we are in the month of Ramadan, and I'm asking you questions regarding fasting and the month of Ramadan. So far, we have covered some questions, and you provided appropriate answers to those questions. Let me start this episode with this question. You know, we all know that there are two sides to a ritual or to a devotional act. One is the intention, and the other one is the very act that every Muslim, for example, does his or her ritual. So it is very important we all know that how intention is as a kind of pre-step, let's say, to the act itself. But the question is, do we have to utter the niyyah, the intention, verbally? Is it the necessary condition for the intention to be actualized or not?
Well, niyyah or the intention is an integral part of every act of ibadah, every act of worship. And without niyyah, of course, the act is not considered an act of ibadah. It's not, it's null and void, okay? Because innama al-a'malu bin-niyyat, no religious deed is acceptable without the intention. Without the intention. So when it comes to uttering the niyyah or verbally reciting that niyyah, it's commonly believed that we have to utter the niyyah, okay? And people say, people who are not very much well-informed, they continue to think that, okay, they have to utter the niyyah, say it verbally, otherwise the niyyah is not established. And this is what people and the general public believe. But that's not the case, okay? Reciting the niyyah is not a necessary condition. It's not mandatory to say it verbally. To pass it through your mind, yes, and to have to just act in a way, and to conduct yourself in a way to suggest that you are actually observing fast, or that you're doing an act of ibadah, whether it's prayer, whether it's let's say performing ghusl or any act, okay, is allowed. So verbally reciting the niyyah is not necessary. To just have it in your mind, or to just pass it through your mind that you are going to fast the next day, it is sufficient, okay? And let me further explain, and there is something we need to know, that fasting becomes, that niyyah becomes obligatory when you start fasting, okay? When do you start fasting? You start fasting at the time of Adhan, okay, or in the beginning of the month, okay? You can form your niyyah or your intention before starting, before the call for prayer, the Fajr prayer. Every day you can
renew your
intention. But it's even permissible to make niyyah for the whole Ramadan, okay? Okay, I'm going to fast for this month of Ramadan, inshallah. And, of course, this is just a niyyah, okay? And it's not necessary to say that, oh, okay, I'm going to fast this month of Ramadan. To have this intention is enough. And also, every day you can make separate niyyah, or form your niyyah every day before the Adhan for Fajr prayer. Sometimes you might forget.
Yes,
to make that
niyyah. Is one of the other questions that I wanted to ask you. What if somebody forgets it?
Yeah, if you happen to forget, to forgive making niyyah, of course you have time till the noon prayer, or till midday to make your niyyah. If you happen to forget, you have time from Adhan till the till noon to form your intention to make your niyyah for the obligatory fast, okay? We are talking about obligatory fast, not about mustahab fast, because when it comes to the difference between mustahab and obligatory fast, there is a difference in the niyyah, of course. As for the mustahab niyyah, mustahab fast, you have time to make niyyah of fasting till even minutes before the Maghrib time.
I see.
Maghrib time.
Before the breakfast.
If you have not eaten anything from dawn to sunset, And you have still got some minutes, okay, some minutes. You can make niyyah of fasting and you will gain the reward of fasting,
mm-hmm.
okay? But this is not the case with the obligatory fast. You cannot, without any excuse, refrain or, let's say, ignore the niyyah. You must make niyyah of fasting
mm-hmm.
Before the Fajr prayer and before the call for prayer. And if there was an excuse, like let's say forgetfulness, okay?
Yes.
Forgetfulness is an excuse. It's mm-hmm. a justified excuse. If you happen to forget, then you have time to make niyyah until midday. But if the midday passes, mm-hmm. then your fast becomes void because you have been fasting, you have not, without any niyyah. And niyyah is an integral part of our fasting.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
There's one thing also to understand.
Okay.
And that is, if you, for example, you are in the month of Ramadan and it's daytime and you should be fasting, and you are actually fasting, but for a few seconds, for 1 minute or 2 minutes, you start hesitating whether you should fast today or you should not fast. That even can make your fast void, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because in that moment of hesitation, you are not sure whether you are fasting or not, whether you should fast or not. And that makes your fast void, even for a few seconds. If you just cancel your intention and let's say that I'm not going to fast, and then after 1 minute, okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to fast, okay, this will make your fast void. Okay, in
I
the
see.
Middle of the day, you just stop your niyyah of fasting and you give up fasting without even eating or drinking anything. This is one of the invalidating agents, okay, to stop your niyyah of fasting and then getting back to that niyyah, it will make your fast void. Okay?
I see.
Because without the niyyah of complying with God's order and without niyyah of taqarrub, your fast is not going to be
valid. I see. Thank you, Sheikh Saeed, for that answer. Let me ask you a very complicated but yet sometimes common
yes.
kind of question. You know, we all know that people may have missed
sure.
some of their obligatory fasting, all right?
Yes.
So imagine this person who has some obligatory fasts to observe.
Yes.
Can the same person make the niyyah of mustahab fast?
Mm-hmm.
For example, fasting is mustahab on the 27th of Rajab, right?
Yes.
Or on the 9th of Zilhijjah.
Yes.
Right? Can this person make the niyyah of fasting on these days to, in fact, obtain the rewards
mm-hmm.
of God for these mustahab fasts while they have missed out some of these obligatory fasts as well as the fast to observe? So they have to observe these fasts.
Yeah, some people are very much, anxious to gain sawab of mustahab fast.
Mm-hmm.
And they are more interested, I'm sorry to say that, they are more interested in mustahab fast rather than obligatory fast. They have their obligatory fast to observe, but they have not been able to give the qada of the obligatory fast, and they want to gain the sawab of the mustahab fast. So they cannot combine between these two, okay? Of course, as long as you have the obligatory fast to observe, you cannot observe mustahab fast, okay? And this is something about which all scholars are agreed. There's consensus about it. Okay, no matter who you are following as your marja, mm-hmm. all the religious authorities agree that that as long as you have obligatory fast, as long as you have qada fast, you cannot observe mustahab fast. Okay,
mm-hmm.
and of course on these occasions, as you rightly mentioned, like the 27th of let's say
Rajab,
and the and of course. The 9th of Zilhijjah, these are the days on which, for example, fasting is recommended.
Yes.
A person can observe his qada fast on these days, and he will gain the sawab of fasting on these days. Even though he is fasting, he is observing the obligatory fast, he is observing his qada fast, but then he will be granted and given sawab for his for fasting on these holy days.
Yes, because I ask this question because you know, some people think that okay, if they you know, there is a kind of coincidence basically mm-hmm.
yes.
happening, right? So because it's very much mustahab or recommended to fast on these special occasions,
yes,
all right, so they put their obligatory fast on the same day so that they can gain both rewards.
Yeah,
does it happen?
Yeah, they will because it's, you know, fasting on this day is recommended. But okay, you have your qada fast and you observe it on the same day, you will yes. get the sawab of fasting on this day.
Yes.
But it is not permissible to observe one fast with two niyyah.
Right. So one, the niyyah must be clear.
Yeah, must be clear. One, the niyyah of obligatory fast, the niyyah of qada fast, and also the niyyah of recommended fast.
Mm-hmm.
One action cannot be done with two intentions.
Thank you very much. There are many more questions that I hopefully, God willing, will ask you in the next episodes to come. Thank you very much for accepting our offer and coming to the studio and shedding some light on these questions related to this special holy month of Ramadan. If there is a cream of the crop for everything, if there is a bride for everything, I guess that Ramadan is the cream of the crop, the bride of all months that there are to it in these 12 months. So please keep us in your du'as, especially in this holy month. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
O you who have faith, prescribed for you is fasting as it was prescribed for those who were before you, so that you may be God-wary.
رمضان زمان الحسنات
رمضان زمان البركات رمضان زمان الحسنات رمضان زمان البركات رمضان
مجال الصلوات تسمو بالنفس لمولاها
رمضان مجال الصلوات تسمو بالنفس لمولاها
Inside Israel.
The social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But of course, we know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities, such as, for example, Bnei Brak, As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence and increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short-term, which relates to the corona. The long-term is the attack on institutions, mainly by Netanyahu, over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. Recently, the people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. You can see the results in the decline of trust, and in the short term relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor, and just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat, and we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, and we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years. No wonder people lose trust, and when they lose trust,
This is very dangerous. So I agree, this is a great, great danger to Israel, the internal crisis, the internal feud. First of all, there's the old division between secular Jews or non-Orthodox Jews and Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. This has a long history of there's a community that pay less taxes. They don't study the core issues like math and English, etc., which are necessary to modern world. Many of the men don't work, and they don't serve in the army like all of us. I served, my children served, and my granddaughter now is in the army. So to look at a community that doesn't take part in the national effort is very infuriating. Come the corona, and you see these people defying the orders of the Minister of Health, and they are getting infected. I think the Israelis would have accepted anything if they had leadership who would tell them, you know what, everybody has now to pay something. People who can, people who make a lot of money should have paid, should have been taxed to help others survive this. But you need leadership for this.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Shimon says, an economic and social crisis in Israel. No services for welfare for 2 weeks. Leo says, Israel starting war to cover the economic and social crisis in Israel. Thousands of Israelis renewed weekly demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for the long-serving Prime Minister to resign over corruption charges against him and his alleged mishandling of the coronavirus crisis.
Israeli public, it has no belief in its officials, in its government, in all the how do you call it, the government offices. There's no belief in them, in none belief. The police is enforced is using extra power for on children, on elderly, on just people that are in the streets. On one hand, and on the other hand, other people do whatever they want. Nobody believes anybody anymore. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. And the thing is, why the people went down to the streets is because of the disbelief. And what a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of people are saying, we do not want to go back to, it's in Hebrew, it's called the old good state of Israel. We do not want to go there because it wasn't good for a lot of us. It wasn't good for the Palestinians. It wasn't good for the Mizrahim, it wasn't good for the Ethiopians, it wasn't good for a lot of people, basically. It wasn't good for the poor. So basically, I think people are saying, we want something that is completely new. We don't trust any of the politicians that are changing parties from, you know, they've been in this party, and now they want to go in this party, and now they're separating and they're combining. Most of the public does not believe the public figures in Israel almost anymore. There's no trust.
The effects of the political and economic crises and the strength of their negative effects largely stem from the way they were managed. Israelis blame the regime for the mismanagement of the coronavirus crisis. Opinion polls have recently showed the existence of a loss of confidence in the regime, Israel's leaders, and institutions. This loss of confidence has negatively affected the Israeli population's readiness to implement anything the regime tells it. Businesses, including restaurants, have failed to adhere lockdown procedures. The poll also shows that most Israelis support the continuation of the demonstrations and protests. This even in the backdrop of their deteriorating economic and social conditions. This is, of course, a huge threat to the Israeli regime. The demands of the protesters have begun with the downfall of Netanyahu, but these protesters have went on to ask for the dissolution of the cabinet and Knesset and a fourth election. In December, their demands are met. Now, with a fourth election set for March, the weekly anti-regime protests still continue with more people joining. A recent survey by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 83% of Israelis believe that there is no social solidarity there. According to this poll, 74% of Israelis say that they do not trust parliament, that is the Knesset, and cannot rely on it in the face of the pandemic. 70% do not trust the cabinet, 63% of them do not trust finance ministry officials, 51% of them do not trust the police, and 47% do not trust the Ministry of Health.
Statesman is not a politician. A statesman thinks about the future of the country and what's good for the country. The politician thinks about the next election and what's good for him. And what we see today, we have politicians. We don't have the statesmen. We don't have the people who give us a vision. Just think about the Israelis today, they don't have hope. There's nobody they believe in who can speak to them and tell them the truth. If it's hard, Israelis know to go through hardships, but they need leaders, statesmen, to believe in. And we don't have these people right now. So let's see what happens in the next elections. I believe, I look at the protest, the hundreds of thousands of Israel taken to the streets, and there are some people who are doing it for week after week, you know, in cold weather, rain or shine. And I know many of the young people who go to the process, and I see a lot of potential there. So. And also, I'm a sworn optimist, so I believe that we will see a new generation of people emerging out of this crisis and taking over. I think Israelis want a direction. Israelis are willing to go through a lot of hardships, but show us where we are going. If you look at the, for example, the handling of the current corona crisis. The businesses are closing down. People are laid off. I don't know if they when corona goes away, they will find any job anymore. And in the meantime, our leaders throwing money like from the helicopter on everybody, people who need it, people who don't need it. With no any plan of how we make a crisis into an opportunity. For example, strengthen the public health system. The reason why we survived this crisis is because we have Kupot Cholim, we have the public health organization, which are so strong and so accessible to the public. Look at the vaccination, how well it goes, because we have all those organizations which have been shrinking over the years because of lack of funds. And suddenly we have so much money to throw on everybody instead of investing in in the public health system.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Sir Distick on Twitter says the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that individual members of the Israeli security forces, in the course of their response to the demonstrations, killed and injured civilians who were neither directly participating in hostilities nor posing an imminent threat. Yehi asks, what about the demonstrations against Bibi, the ones going on for months all through this pandemic? Jankowski says thousands of Israelis renewed their weekly demonstrations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him to step down as Tel Aviv went into third COVID-19 lockdown. Since last year, Israel has been witnessing demonstrations everywhere.
It's a mistake to think that the public was out in the streets only to demand that the government will be dispersed. And it was a mistake, and there's also a mistake. A lot of people think that the demand is to interrogate all kinds of things, like the selling of the submarines or the buying of the submarines also to Egypt or to whoever. I'm not too involved in that issue. I think some of the public is out there saying we want a government that is not corrupt. But a lot of people are out in the streets, or a lot of people are not out in the streets, but basically they feel that they do not want to go back to business as usual. They do not want any government. And also there's something I didn't mention, because on the last elections, one of the Kahol Levan party received a lot of voices. They received a lot of people voted for them, and the hope was that they would send Netanyahu to trial or to, you know, or home, basically. And they sold the public. They went into coalition with the Netanyahu government. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. People feel that the vaccinations, a lot of people are happy to take them, but a lot of people feel that the vaccinations, the fact that Israel has been receiving so many vaccinations, people feel that Israel is like, is the government is allowing people to be, the companies to do experiments on people here in Israel. So basically, the sense of disbelief is tremendous all over. And actually, when you look at what's happening around in Israel, you see the Palestinians for 48, talking Umm al-Fahim and cities within Israel. It's an uprise now. They're in the streets. There's police. Children of 14 years old are being arrested violently. You have these collisions with the Nebak, with the Orthodox cities. You have it almost everywhere. Israel is extremely in uprests all around. There's nothing, you know, we've been out in the streets for 30 weeks now in Balfour in Jerusalem, but not only there. So basically, there's a big the society is in a situation of unrest. And also people feel that the fact that they were going to elections in the fourth time in 2 years, it's the feeling that there's no government. There's no head of police. There's all kinds of positions that are not occupied because the government, Netanyahu, is not, the government isn't functioning.
It Israel has lost control of coronavirus for several reasons, the annual strategic assessment of Israel said. The most important of which is the loss of internal political stability and the failure of the Israelis to respond to the instructions of their regime. To this day, much of the Israeli public believes the coronavirus is a natural disaster, mainly due to their distrust of the regime. But it is important to note that these issues only shed light on underlying crises that have been ignored. Now, the social problem is a national and strategic security threat for Israel, one that has shaken the highest echelons of the regime.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Dear Muslim ladies, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, especially this program, Muslim Ladies, so welcome. In this episode of Muslim Lady, the scholar of this program, Sister Razia Shameli and Sister Zainab Barakat, will be talking about pregnancy. But first, Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints on the role of women, a sensitive job that builds the future. In Imam Khamenei's point of view, the pivotal role of women in the family, which focuses on the upbringing and education of human beings and the growth and prosperity of the human race, is an irreplaceable role that no one but a woman can do. Therefore, homemaking is a sensitive job that builds the future, and nothing is as important as a mother's work. Homemaking is a sensitive job that builds the future. One of the most important responsibilities of women is being a homemaker. As everybody knows, I do not believe that women should not have social and political roles. There is nothing wrong with this, but if this means that we should look down on homemaker, then we have committed a sin. Homemaking is a job. It is a great, important, and sensitive job which builds the future. Giving birth to children is a great effort.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, I'm a person. And Allah has given me a choice that's free. So Alhamdulillah, I choose to be a Muslim. And there's nothing else I'd rather be. No, there's nothing else I'd rather be.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have my friend and sister in faith, Sister Razia Shameli. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my beloved friend.
How do you do?
Sister, alhamdulillah, I'm doing great.
Thank you so very much for being with us
thank
today.
Thank you for having me here.
We're talking about the necessary steps a human being, an individual, has to take pre-pregnancy, which I think all starts with correcting their worldview.
Exactly.
And their opinion toward life and their purpose and objective on this earth. If your worldview has been distorted and mutilated into having you think that I've been created to make more money, I've been created to, you know, have skincare routines every night to remain fabulous and gorgeous and young forever.
To have so many followers.
To have so many followers and likes on Instagram and Facebook. Then, yeah, probably having children is not for you.
Even getting married,
because why ruin that? You know, you're yeah. so... all of that is
you have everything.
To, yeah, all of that is, to an extent, going to compromise your...
Goals in life.
Goals in life. Or, you know, yeah, you can go find yourself someone who is more aligned with you regarding those perspectives and